White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Yeah, here we are in the bunker. In the bunker, right here in north central Indiana. This is Terrible Tommy and our P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Thank you for getting your donations in. And if you get too far behind, we're going to bump you, boy or girl. Yeah, it's a nice day here in the Midwest. Flowers are growing. My new tomato plants are coming up real good. I got some onion plants out there. We got all kinds of stuff growing here. Getting ready to have some feasts in the fall, man. In the fall equinox. Yeah. Well, what do you think, boys? If you've been watching any TV, you'll see that the mud flood is in high gear. The old mud flood. I'm telling you. I know it's sadder than hell. You want to cry, but you can't cry because you're too busy loading your guns. The mud flood is creeping onto the beaches of Europe, the ancestral homeland, and all they can do is talk about what we're going to do to save them, what we're going to do to bring them in. And now the UN, and maybe this was why this EU was set up in the first place. So, you know, we know it took the control from each nation out of their control, really. And now they're saying, we got to figure a way of saving all these people. Well, if you want to save them, quit tearing up Africa. Before all this intervention of Western armies into Africa, there wasn't that much coming out that couldn't be controlled. But now, because of our intervention, occupation, and blowing the shit out of everything, and even down in deep territorial Africa, where they got set up these little mini dictators and give them all kinds of the best weapons and everything, and people running for their lives, you see, that's what happens. And white Europeans are sitting back and saying, well, wonder what's going on there. Why are all those people trying to get in a dinghy or on a boat or on a barge and get out of there? But the fact remains, it has to be stopped, but it won't be stopped, boys and girls. You've listened to me long enough to know that this is not going to stop. Oh, I almost forgot, boys and girls, our She-Wolf Day, Friday, Freya's Day, and we have a request here this morning, so I'm going to run it through to you, and it's we're going to run it, this version is the Jersey Boys. Yeah, it's called Oh, What a Night.
John Glenn is the first American to orbit the Earth. We go out on our first cross-country tour. The label's raking it in, so they send over some girls when we hit Chicago at Christmas. And that night, I rack up a personal first. Oh, what a night. Late December back in 63. What a very special time for me. As I remember, what a night. Oh, what a night. You know I didn't even know her name. But I was there. What a lady, what a
stocks as we continue our in-depth biotech.
Here we go. The pot calling the pan black. Susan Pollock, a Hungarian Jew and Holocaust survivor, is grateful that the man she calls the last Nazi is finally on trial in Germany. Well, boy, did you get a wrong number, baby. If you think he's the last Nazi, you're a little bit off course there, I think. She's among 70 co-plaintants in the trial of Oscar Gröning, a former Nazi who went on trial this week on 300,000 separate counts of accessory to murder of the Jews. Well, I see a picture of him. He looks good, pretty good. He looks better than she does. They got pictures of this Jewess that's so happy. She looks older than the German fellow, Oscar Gröning. While Susan admits that the trial will be hard, she says that she's willing to go because it's important. It's a feeling of triumph that we lived in a different world today, she told the Telegraph. However, she stressed the importance of her role as a witness in the Holocaust, bringing the Germans to justice. I should take the Nazi out, German. Susan Pollock was born Susanna Blau in Felsogród, Hungary, in 1930. She was sent to Auschwitz at age 14 and was the only member of her family to survive the Holocaust. She lost 50 members of her extended family. She was moved from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen camp, where she was later liberated by British troops. Well, anyhow, this thing goes on and on and on. Well, let me give Susan a little lesson in history. You remember all those wars in Europe and leading up to World War I? Susan, do you realize how much Jew finance through the Rothschilds and the Warburgs and so forth brought on that problem of the First World War, which killed millions and millions, maybe 40 million people, most of them not Jews? You remember how many Jews actually fought on the different sides, killing people, and the tremendous atrocity of the First World War? And guess what? If it had been for World War I, there never would have been a Hitler. So all you Jews that are crying all the time, let's go back a little bit. Where was the money coming from? Not only the First World War, but the Second World War. Of course Hitler was financed by a lot of Jews. We know their names. So what is the pot calling the pan black? Jews never want to tell the whole story. And their conspirators, the neocon Christians, they don't want to tell the whole story either. That's the problem. You can't just tell half the story or 25% of the story. You got to tell the whole story and get it from all sides. And you know some of the things I've been reading to you lately paint a pretty much different picture than what we're sold on history books and so forth nowadays. So I'm not going to cry for you, Susan. You're alive. You look like hell, I'll tell you that. Mr. Gröning looks about 40 years younger than you, so he's doing pretty good so far. Next time somebody throws up to you about this World War I, World War II, or World War II, say, wait a minute. Let's go back in history of what set up the First World War, who financed the First World War, and who made tremendous amounts of money, like the Rothschilds were making tremendous amounts of money all over Europe. Of course, they've been doing that by fomenting wars all the way back. And it led directly to Hitler coming to power. So what do you got to say about that, Jew boy? Like when I say to the federal government, if you don't like me, why did you create me? It's sort of like that with Hitler and those kind of guys. If you didn't like them, why did you create them? You could say the same thing about Saddam Hussein or all those guys over there. You say you don't like what you like for a while and then you don't like them. if you don't like those leaders over there that are trying to rip you a new asshole, why did you create them? If you don't like Obama, all you white people out there, why did you vote for him? The fools. What fools. Those that are always wailing against the socialists. The socialists were against the First World War and fought against the First World War that led to the Second World War. Mostly the socialists in Europe were fighting against wars too. So when you start condemning socialists, you better think about how many socialists were peacemakers. And then make a list of all the conservative right-wing types and military types and what their actions are and opinions are on war. They're all for war, as long as they don't get hurt.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've got a lot to talk about. And I think, you know, the first question really coming to you would be, you know, you've written a tremendous number of books into the hidden history of especially the British Empire, right? The Hidden King of England, Hitler was a British agent, and also your book about Stalin being a British agent. Where does most of this intelligence come from? Because obviously most people would say that it doesn't seem to be be lent by tradition, by the regular history books. So, A, how did you get down this rabbit hole in a sense of going down the uncharted territories of British imperial history, but all of our history?
Well, history that comes from the mainstream is bunkum. It's just a PR exercise written by the winner of the war. And most of the leaders of the militaries and opposing militaries have each other's phone numbers during that war. And it's all a collusion. And the collusion is to put a country into war, which is the most expensive thing a country can do, and borrow a huge amount of money from the central bank, and then send their own citizens out to be killed, like the British leader will send British citizens out to be killed, and the German leader will send German citizens out to be killed, and the Russian leader will send Russian citizens out to be killed. And each one of those deaths has a value in the International Bank of Settlements. And they have been cashed in to fund the war. And the winner of the war pays the war debts of the loser of the war. So no one wants to win the war or end the war. And in the case of World War II, Hitler had won the war. There was like no war for 9 months. Hitler rushed in 2 weeks and had all of Britain, all of the British forces in Europe, trapped at Dunkirk. And Hitler allowed them to escape because the war had to continue. And if Germany won the war, they would have to pay the war debts of England. And Germany hadn't had enough of its own citizens killed to pay back its loans via the International Bank of Settlements. So the way we view war is entirely the opposite to the way it is viewed by those who are charging people's lives and deaths via the International Bank of Settlements.
Mm-hmm. But, for example, when it comes to the notion that enough citizens had to die, is this because the citizens themselves are the collateral for the country's
yes.
debt?
Yeah, citizens are the collateral off their birth certificate.
Right. And so it's always been that situation then, at least for throughout the 20th century.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's a culling exercise. And at the end of the war, no country had gained any ground. Same with World War One and World War Two. You know, there was a bit of flip-flop where the Soviets were given a bit of East Germany. But that actually came about because the Soviets went to Gotha and destroyed the Royal Almanac de Gotha printing plates, which were printed by Justus Perthes. And in exchange for that, Russia was given a large section of Germany for 50 years or so. And that's why General Patton was delayed for 9 days. It was so that the Russians could individually destroy the Almanac de Gotha printing plates. And I don't mean blow it up and then set fire to it. I mean individually smash up each plate so that it is beyond recognition. And then go back, blow it up, check it, go back through all the rubble and blow it up again, go through all the rubble and blow it up again, so that it was totally destroyed. And for that, Russia was given the most southwestern portion of East Germany during the Cold War, and that was called Thuringia.
But is this, and then what was the motivation, what was the reason that was behind the desire to see that almanac destroyed?
By 1945, King George VI recognized that there were 3 or 4 generations of illegitimacy in the prime members of the British royal family going back to 1834. So the British royal family actually commissioned the Stalin, who was a British agent, to use his Soviet forces to destroy the Royal Almanac de Gotha on their behalf. And because General Patton, the American General Patton, was delayed for 9 days in going into Gotha, he knew that something was up, and he knew that the Russians had destroyed Justice Perth's printing press. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason that General Patton was assassinated.
Right. Because obviously the royal family, the British family that sits on the throne, is a German family. It's called the, the Gotha-Saxe-Coburg or Coburg-Saxe-Gotha.
Yeah, well, they're called Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. Saxe-Coburg and Gotha. But it was really the German Sachsen-Coburg und Gotha. And Prince Albert was supposed to be a Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, but he was illegitimate. He was actually just Albert of Saxony. So the illegitimate Albert of Saxony went to marry Queen Victoria, and they knew that he was illegitimate. Then they changed his name to Saxe-Coburg and Gotha, an anglicized version of a name that actually didn't apply to Prince Albert. Prince Albert was illegitimate. He was Albert of Saxony. And of Saxony just meant that you're an illegitimate closely associated with the duchy. So Queen Victoria actually married the second in line to the British throne, Blind Prince George of Cumberland. They married in 1834. And when she married Prince Albert of Saxony, it was a bigamous marriage. And Prince Albert died a virgin. He never sired any of Queen Victoria's official 9 children. Mm-hmm. And it was only 2.5 years after the last 9th child was born that Albert received the title Prince Consort Albert. Because he was never actually the consort. He received the title Prince Consort Albert, and then he died about 5 years later in 1861, and he was killed by, he was given a cold, caught a slight cold, and then he was put in the blue room at Windsor Castle, chained to the bed, physically chained to the bed, with the windows left open in winter in December, and from that he got pneumonia and died. So Prince Albert was killed, he died a virgin at the age of 42, and did not sire any of Queen Victoria's 9 official children. Mm. And the reason for that was that the Rothschilds wanted to have an illegitimate British royal family so that they could entirely control it.
Right. And then in the case of Stalin, you mentioned being a British agent. Now, most people, I think, who are informed understand that certainly Lenin and Trotsky were deployed, Trotsky, especially from American financial circles of Wall Street, right? Lenin via Germany to destabilize the Tsar, who was as obviously a cousin of the British family at that point, right? One of the children, one of Victoria's cousins, right, or nephews. But what was the motivation then behind this destabilization of Russia and to create the Soviet Republic and having people like Stalin deployed?
Stalin was an illegitimate child of Baron, the French Baron Ferdinand de Rothschild. The French Baron Edmund de Rothschild, who was also the biological father of Chairman Mao, whose name was Mao Zedong. And Mao Zedong is an anagram of Edmund, as in Baron Edmund de Rothschild. So Chairman Mao and Stalin were half-brothers. The French Baron Edmund de Rothschild died, I think it was in 1934, and he left $500,000 US dollars to Chairman Mao, who then went on the Long March, which took several months, and 80% of the people died on the march, but Chairman Mao was actually carried on a palanquin, which is two posts, four people, and a box on top with a bit of a tent structure. So Chairman Mao didn't do any of the walk, and when he got to the end of the walk, there was literally a pot of gold there from a chest full of gold and rubies and magnificently crafted objects. And Chairman Mao said to the others, you can be a part of this if you join me. And that's what launched Chairman Mao's career, is that he was one of the richest men in China in 1934.
And as for Stalin, in terms of Russia, I mean, what was the
most... Stalin was trained in England at least from 1907. And then in 1910, he did the Houndditch robbery and the Sydney Street siege, which were both in December 1910. Churchill was training Stalin, and they were second cousins. Churchill ran an exercise, the Sydney Street Siege. That was a military exercise done in public. And Churchill was the Home Secretary, and he was running it. And Stalin escaped, quite obviously, by knocking a hole through the wall, going to the next apartment, and then getting dead bodies, and then throwing them into the building that was under the apartments that were under siege, and then setting fire to those apartments. And it was done so obviously that one of the bodies that they put into the apartment that was under siege and then set fire to, it had two legs missing, and it was still believed. And then Churchill used that to buy guns for the English police. And the brand of guns that he used was an English brand that Churchill had a financial investment in, and they were really quite useless guns. And during the siege, all the police were given rifles that would not shoot in a straight line and were incredibly underpowered, whereas the Russians had Mausers, which were very accurate and very powerful, so that three Russians could outwit and outshoot 30 British police. Yeah. And then Stalin escaped with the loot and went to Europe and carried on. He robbed a lot of banks. Stalin robbed a lot of banks, and he robbed a lot of Jewish jewelry stores.
In terms of it, and ultimately, I mean, he secured his power base, obviously, and inside of what had been laid out for him by, again, the revolution that overthrew.
He was just a player. He was just a player. Like, Churchill, Hitler, and Stalin all knew each other from 1910 to 1912. Hitler was trained in the Tavistock in Ireland and England, and then the Tavistock in Ireland closed down. But Hitler was in England from February 1912 to May 1913. And if you look closely at Hitler's, the official biographies of Hitler, there is no biography for that time, and they muffle it.
Right. But Bridget Hitler says he was there. That was his brother, it was his brother's wife, right, says that he was in England at that time.
Yeah, yeah. he absolutely was in England. And there was a documentary done on it last year of Hitler living in the apartment at Stanhope Street in Liverpool. And they only showed it in Zone 4, which is the area around Liverpool. They didn't show it in the areas of London or southwest England or northeast England. So, you know, it was a controlled release. But the last bomb of World War II actually destroyed the whole row of buildings in Stanhope Street, which is where Hitler lived in 1912.
But what is the proof that we have?
It's a con, you know. So the British were actually, and a lot of the bombings during World War II and a lot of the blitzes, the British were actually bombing their own targeted buildings. They would actually ring up the British High Command would ring up the German High Command and say, we need this building bombed because, you know, it's got a bit of history we don't like. And often the Germans would bomb everything around that building and miss the building. And then the British would plant bombs inside that surviving building they didn't want and then wind up the air raid siren. Everyone would go into the bunkers and then they would blow up their own building. Yeah, in London as well.
The beginning of false flag terrorism. But
absolutely.
And we know terror bombing, that whole concept of terror comes from that time period of World War II with the bombing campaigns that were designed to hit civilians, but by both the British, you know, and the Germans. But the question being, with the Tavistock Institute, we know that they're notorious for brainwashing campaigns and obviously launching a lot of operations post-World War as well. But how do we know that Hitler was at the Tavistock Institute when he was in England?
Because when he turned up to his sister-in-law Bridget Hitler's house, he had all the signs of being mind-controlled, and his subconscious was still working through it.
Like a somnambulist.
Sort of dilated pupils, talking in grandeur, out of context, raving and ranting about what he was going to achieve, etc. But he did achieve most of the things he wanted to achieve, but what he actually did was create Israel.
Well,
Hitler fulfilled the Balfour Agreement.
Right, which is an interesting concept.
Even Jews in Israel have been interviewed in documentaries saying that we should actually have a picture of Hitler hanging over the mantelpiece because he's the one that created Israel.
Right. Well, the transfer agreement.
It's not a tasteful thing, but...
Yeah, the whole premise necessary to obviously give birth to the state. But as far as, again, going back to this notion of how these things operate, if Hitler was a British agent, which I think, you know, it does make sense to a degree. If he was a British agent, why at the end of the war would the British collude to get him out of the country to escape when, in fact, he could, you know, that could only be a liability on their part? Why wouldn't they want to see him die at the end of the war and, you know, basically just bury the history with him?
Oh, they did. They killed six Hitler body doubles on top of the bunker. And they got the real one out to Spain and a doppelganger or two out to Argentina.
Well, obviously,
the American spies, you know, the G spies, were all trained to spy on the fake Hitler in Argentina and to keep a very well documented portfolio on his movements.
Right. Well, that's why recently we've seen the FBI files coming out saying, you know, Hitler was alive in Argentina, but that probably was the double that they were showing pictures of, right?
Yeah. You know, my theory is that there were 18 doubles because in 1933. Hitler had a Gaul doppelganger competition. And the officials would go around to all the areas, and people would come up who looked like Hitler, and the winner would get chosen. So he had an abundance of body doubles. It appears that one died in Kiev in a plane accident in 1943, and six were shot on top of the bunker. And they were shot with 10.5mm bullets, which is a state-sanctioned high-intelligence bullet, which meant that the bullet came from the German High Command. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So in terms
and
of
a lot of people don't realize that the bunker was two stories high. It was a, you know, the way they show it is a plan, and then there's a stairway, and then there's another plan like that. So you think it's split level, but it was actually one on top of the other, and they had dumb waiters in between the levels. Mm-hmm. So the real Hitler could go up and the fake Hitler could come down and get shot.
Right. Well, I mean, it came out recently that the skull that they said they'd been saying since the end of World War II, right, that was Hitler's skull, turned out to be a female skull, right? And obviously, yeah. We know Stalin never believed that Hitler is dead. Even Eisenhower said he was still at large, right, after the war.
Yeah.
It was pretty, for a certain period of time, it was pretty clear that it was, you know, it was just the facade, the idea of Hitler having killed himself, kind of like this. But I kind of want to bring it up to the present day, because here you have like the stories around bin Laden, and it's very similar. It resonates in many ways in a similar sense about, you know, the notion of their boogeyman. Are there doubles of bin Laden? Right? Was the real bin Laden dead by the time of 2001 occurring? Right? Who was ultimately killed? I mean, I just want to get into this question of really where the game, how the game works, because people need to understand the landscape. Obviously, they understand, you know, this empire plays games of putting agents into power and then basically deploying them to be the villain, right, and having this kind of charade.
Yeah,
how is that working on the present landscape? You know, is that where the bin Laden story fits in?
Yeah, well, bin Laden had body doubles and he's in business with the Bushes. And he was an agent who would have employed body doubles to act as his military agent. Saddam Hussein was the same. He was appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 1. And Saddam Hussein was employed by Bush to, as a teenager, about 19 years old, to go around on roller skates around the streets of Iraq and fix turtle bombs, or frog bombs, and fix them onto the petrol caps of diplomatic vehicles that were going to peace conferences. And then you twist it and then skate away, and 10 seconds later a bolt of flame would shoot through into the petrol tank and blow up all the occupants.
This is young Saddam. You're talking about young Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, young Saddam Hussein. But there was one guy who went around Iraq like 20 years earlier and had sex with a lot of women paying not much money to get them pregnant to all produce similar-looking people. And there were actually 50 Saddam Husseins.
The doubles.
50 doubles. And there was schoolteacher Saddam. There was goat herder Saddam. There was lawyer Saddam. There was politician Saddam. There was ranting Saddam. And schoolteacher Saddam ended up living with Mrs. Saddam and the children and raising them as his own. Right? So even Mr. Saddam Hussein, the family man, was a fake.
Right.
And when he was found in the bunker underground, you know, he had more than 3 months beard growth. And the fruits and leaves on the outside of the tree were out of season, so obviously that was filmed beforehand.
Yeah, they've been filmed.
And then when he was executed, that was faked as well. And when he's hung, that was fake as well.
Well, obviously we live in a world, I mean, it becomes clear, I think, to those who study history, who study the situations, who look at what's going on, who see the patterns. They say, look, this world is not what the media portrays. It's not a reality we're living in. How advanced are the technologies of, you know, of the empire? Let's say, you know, given your intelligence operatives that you talk to and spy master, people like this, are we talking about a world where the elite have access to UFO type of technology, of basically disc type of technologies like the Nazis were developing at that point? Are we talking about very advanced beings that are actually present here, or does the elite have access to this type of advanced technology, cloning technologies, things like this, Star Trek in a sense?
Well, if you think about it, the technology that we've got available to us is a cell phone and a computer and the internet and Skype and maybe a bit of video editing equipment. And if we're really talented, we can layer the video to make something else appear on it. They have everything else.
but what does everything else entail? Like, how advanced is
software? Everything else is basically everything that you can imagine as being scientific and worked through and made functional and then streamlined and stylized and miniaturized and increased by power by tenfold. Mm-hmm. They have all of that.
Right.
Including, you know, underground maglev train systems that go right across America, submarines going under the sea to the center of America, massive underground bases.
Right.
Massive.
Did the Nazis...
Everything. And, you know, UFOs, anti-gravity machines, they were functioning and flying from the... there's the Freiburg crash in 1936, and they'd back engineered the Freiburg UFO anti gravity craft. That was functioning by 1939, and then went through a series of phases of improvement, so that it's so fast now you just can't see it. Mm. So you gotta wonder, if you see a UFO hovering in the sky, is that real? Because it's so fast, you either can't see it or don't believe you've just seen it.
Right. But now, speaking of the underground concept, I mean, a lot of the lore around the Nazis was that they did relocate to New Schwabenland, right, in Antarctica, and set up some kind of base there. Did you find evidence for this?
There is actually evidence for that, and I've spoken to some people who have been based around Christchurch who knew about that. And when the Americans flew to Antarctica, Christchurch in the South Island of New Zealand, that was their landing and leaving base. And when they were flying to Christchurch, they would call it NS, which meant New Spain. New Zealand was referred to as NS, New Spain. And because New Spain, New Zealand was the leaving point to the seventh continent, Antarctica, and Spain was the leaving point to the sixth continent, America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in terms of the Admiral Byrd expedition, for example, was that actually to find, you know, to find the Nazi base there, or
well,
to?
Well, no, essentially, Admiral Byrd faked his death, or his death was faked, because after his death, he was in Auckland talking to military and intelligence agents in August 1961, and he finished the meeting by saying, "Hush, hush, you've got to keep my presence here totally secret." And that wasn't revealed to me until about 2007. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But did he find... I mean, what do you have any indication of what he actually found when he went down there to the poles, the South Pole?
He found UFOs that absolutely trounced his own ships and aircraft, and the Americans lost and got a complete tail whipping. Yeah.
So ultimately, to clarify, it seems to be that we're dealing with an empire that is human-based, right? The so-called Illuminati-type groups around the major financiers, the central bankers, right? And then we also have extraterrestrial presences on the planet.
I avoid the alien thing, you know, because of the spoof aspect. So I don't really talk about it, but you know, there's a fair amount of evidence for it, but the evidence that you see appears to be 99% mocked up and fake.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if there are aliens, they didn't arrive in the 1970s.
No,
they didn't arrive at the same time as hallucinogenic drugs. I think they've been here. If they've been here, they've been here. Thousands of years.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Thousands of years, and maybe they operate in a slightly out of phase frequency to us, so we don't actually see them too often.
Right. So what?
No,
I've
never met an alien, so I can't say three things.
Fine. Fair enough. So let's just treat it as such, as the empire, basically the breakaway civilization concept of, you know, the elite, that they have the technology we're talking about.
I'd like to introduce a concept into the UFO landing in 1936 in Freiburg in Germany, and the UFO landing in 1947 in Roswell. I think that, you know, they both happened, but there were different styles of cover-ups on them both. The Roswell was covered up with spoof, and the Freiburg crash was covered up with total non-disclosure and denial. And so I think from the Freiburg crash in 1936, because that came down, it was advanced technology that needed back engineering, they wanted to attract the best scientists in the world to back engineer the Freiburg UFO. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to give that an operational name, and I think that was Operation Clip Paper.
Pop Paperclip.
No. Operation Paperclip after World War II, getting all the scientists out of Germany. But I think Operation Clip Paper was bringing the scientists into Germany from 1936 to 1939, right? Now, the interesting thing that happened is my great-grandfather, Ernest Robert Godwood, was acknowledged as the world's foremost authority on the combustion engine in the 1930s. And officially, he died on a ship just outside Marseille on the 8th of December, 1936, which is just after the Freiburg crash. And then the ship that he was on the next day crashed into another ship, which meant that his body couldn't have been refrigerated and it was too close to shore to dump at sea. And I think that he was stolen under Operation Clip Paper to back engineer the Freiburg UFO because he was the world's foremost authority on the combustion engine.
Right, right. So this whole notion of...
He developed this Godwood gas generator which would operate on petrol, diesel, kerosene, mess, and vegetable oil. Mm-hmm. And at the same time he had a mansion in Queens Drive, Windsor, and the mansion disappeared, all his money disappeared,
right,
and all of his patents disappeared.
Right. The whole notion of faking someone's death and then basically giving them a new life that's, you know, belongs to secret of operations, whatever they're trying to conduct. But again, it just gets to me to the essence of what I want to get at for the, you know, at the end here is, what are they doing with us beyond, you know, this power structure, this elite that has so much foresight and awareness, obviously, to create conflicts, to overthrow governments for their purposes? Is it ultimately just culling the herd? Is that the way that they see the planet? It's basically a herd of cattle that need to be culled occasionally and, you know, that's and fleeced and slaughtered when necessary. Is that really what it boils down to?
You've got to look at the Sabbatean Francus. They came up with a choice for the world, and that was to create a world that was really wonderful to make the Messiah appear, or was really horrible to make the Messiah appear. And they went with the horrible version. Mm-hmm. So they are, how do I put this politely? They are fucking with you in every way they can.
And this is the Franco-Sabbatian, basically, the Sabbatian cult.
Yeah, right. Sabbatian Francus, yeah. And they're in the Muslim world, and they're in the Catholic world, they're in the Jewish world, they're in the legal world, they're in the military.
Right,
and then they love sociopaths and psychopaths to get power because it helps to create a really horrible world.
And they deploy sort of Babylonian Talmudic magic, Kabbalistic kind of magic when necessary?
Or in their sometimes that's done, but, you know, it's kind of not the cause, you know, it's just like a distraction so that someone can have a rant and think they've solved something. Or sometimes they use it just to identify things and make their mark on it, their secret mark, so that it becomes obvious to those in the know who caused such and such an event because it happened on a certain date.
Right. So again, but that's really the cult that we're looking at, and it's bloodline, and it's a certain bloodline, and it's a certain group that most people would never recognize even if they met a Sabbatian, for example, they wouldn't even necessarily know it.
Well, you know, most contract killers are absolutely charming on the outside.
Greg, where can people find more of your work and your sort of your research these years as an ongoing basis in your journalism?
Theworldoftruth.net. That's got my books on it, and it's got my interviews on it.
Fantastic.
So I've got done about 60 hours worth of interviews. Yeah.
Well, I stumbled onto that today and just thought I'd run it by you here on Friday. And what do you think? I think some of us are very speculative, but some of it rings true. what I've been trying to say, that the Hitler activity in World War II was partly designed to create the State of Israel, which if it had been for World War II and Adolf Hitler, there would not have been a State of Israel today. So that's one thing you got to get in your head. And also that both I and some of the others, Bob, and we talked about that, was why Hitler let the expeditionary forces of the British Empire escape back to Britain. And that's a clue right there. And the next clue, another clue was Barbarossa, the attack on Russia. So it's something to think about. One thing for sure, like I say, you can't trust anybody at the top. They're all sociopaths, psychopaths, and that's why they're in power. Even down to your congressmen and senators in your local state. If they're not that way when they start out, they'll be that way after they've gone to Washington and been told what to think. Or even at the state level. That's why you have to look out for your own personal family interest and those around you who are in the know also. You can't waste your time on the rest of them because they just, number one, they won't listen to you, and number two, they wouldn't do anything if they did.
Neither rain, sleet, nor snow, nor even the likelihood that he'd be killed could stop this letter carrier from making his appointed rounds. Doug Hughes is one gutsy mailman. In April, this rural letter carrier from Florida embarrassed Washington's haughty security hierarchy and threw members of Congress into chaotic panic by boldly flying his tiny, homemade gyrocopter right through the heart of our nation's most restricted airspace, landing it on the front lawn of the U.S. Capitol. Far from a terrorist or a kook, Hughes was just a mailman on a mission. Like most of us, he's disgusted that big money can openly buy lawmakers and laws. But he did more than write a letter to his Congress critter. He wrote letters to all 535 of them, loaded the missives in his mailbag, and literally went the extra mile to make a very special delivery in his gyrocopter. This was no flight of fancy. Doug planned his mail delivery for months, and he was fully aware that he might crash, be killed by a scramble of military jets, or be gunned down by guards when he landed. Nor was it a sneak attack. He repeatedly posted his intentions in blogs, and the Secret Service had investigated and interviewed him about his plans more than a year earlier. His landing jolted the Capitol into lockdown. Guards rushed out to arrest Doug. A bomb squad arrived, and lawmakers were scared silly. They ran around screeching that they were threatened by terrorists. Of course, the real threat to America is not some guy flying a gyrocopter, but the utter corruption of Congress by plutocratic elites whom this mailman targeted with nothing more nor less dangerous than a bagful of truth-telling letters. This is Jim Hightower saying, actually, Hughes was not alone on this heroic mission. The great majority of us Americans are totally on board with his bold effort to finally shape up Congress.
And thank you, Jimmy, for another great spiel. Yeah, I like the post office. They've always treated me right. All my mails always went through. Never had a problem. Don't let them privatize it, whatever you do.
Eyes on the objective. Engage at your discretion.
Roger that. Target lasered. 3, 2, 1, right.
Good kill. War is now a first-person shooter. Half of you were recruited in malls precisely because you are a bunch of gamers.
Any time of day or night,
drones are in the sky above whatever godforsaken place we're at war with that day.
You're cleared hot. Light them up. Warheads on foreheads.
Missiles off the rail.
They don't call it a hellfire for nothing.
So what'd you log? 3,000 hours in F-16s, 6 tours, 200 combat sorties before you got here?
So I heard you want to go back to combat. Are you out of your mind?
Is it so bad what you're doing now? You're still making people safer, right?
Rifle when ready.
Missiles away.
What's that?
Abort.
Negative.
Rania.
Don't ask me if it's a just war. That's not up to us. To us, it's just war.
I am a pilot, and I'm not flying.
I don't know what it is that I am doing,
but it's not flying.
Words come down the chain. We're stepping up attacks. As we got intel, says they're stepping up attacks.
You ever get to fly in a war or something?
Blew away 6 Taliban in Pakistan just earlier today. Now I'm going home to barbecue. Every day I feel like a coward taking pot shots at somebody halfway around the world.
He's quiet. What happens when he gets angry? He gets more quiet.
You just gotta keep compartmentalizing. Never mind, the compartments got too close.
What is it that you miss so bad? Combat?
Okay. Well, there's a film you should see. Good Kill 2014. It's about the drone program, and it's not very sympathetic towards what the drones are doing. I think you'll like it. But if you're gonna, and don't miss that film I recommended to you on Netflix, called Salamander. It's French, with French subtitles, but it's one of the best films on corruption and secret societies inside the government that I've ever seen. It's called Salamander. Well, I wonder what's going to happen now that the Pope has recognized Palestine as a state. The state of Palestine. Now, I wonder what's going to happen to that love affair between Bibi and the Holy See. What do you think about that? It's quite an interesting turn of events. Another turn of events that leads along the down spiral of the state of Israel. Well, with so much attention having been lavished on last week's 70th anniversary of VE Day, another anniversary also connected to World War II passed virtually unnoticed. May 5th marked 30 years since President Ronnie Reagan followed through on his usually controversial decision to participate in a wreath-laying ceremony at Commissar Military Concern Cemetery at Bitburg, Germany, which contained the graves of dozens of Waffen-SS, Hitler's killer elite. For a president and an administration normally so attuned to the importance of image and perception, the incident constituted an unprecedented public relations stumble. Reagan biographer Lou Cannon called it, quote, the seminal symbolic disaster, unquote, of Reagan's presidency. What makes the story even more baffling is that Reagan was widely seen as a warmly disposed and ass-kisser of the Jews and Israel. Few experiences touched him as deeply as he did in his viewing of the Nazi death camp newsreels. Quote, from then on, he said, I was concerned for the Jewish people, unquote. Ronald Reagan also said he went to the death camps, he visited the death camps. And, of course, he was caught in a lie there because he never even left the United States during World War II. In fact, he never left Hollywood during World War II. And Reagan had an instinctive affinity for Israel. Quote, well, like all politicians, you ever find one who didn't? Quote, I believe many things in my life, unquote, he stated in his memoirs, but no conviction I've ever had has been stronger than my belief the United States must ensure the survival of Israel even on our deathbed of a country. Wait a minute. Did I add something to that? As an actor, and that's all he was an actor who spent decades in the heavily Jewish environment of Hollywood and who counted scores of Jews among his friends and colleagues, he moved easily in pro-Israel circles, both as a private citizen and as the governor of California. He was a familiar sight and a favored speaker at various functions on Israel. And friends of mine that I lived near in Fallbrook, California, that worked in the studios in Hollywood laughed about Reagan because they said that on the soundstage when they're making a movie and the actors are on the stage there, they mark X's for them where they're supposed to stand and deliver their lines. And Ronnie Reagan wouldn't get on the right X, and the Jew director would say, you son of a bitch, get on the goddamn X. Cuss him out. Yeah. Reagan credited his parents for his immunity to anti-Semitism. He was often related to the story of how his father, a traveling salesman, was about to check into a hotel in some remote area late one night when the clerk casually remarked, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Wait a minute here. I'm sure you'll enjoy it here. We don't allow any Jews. Whereupon Jack Reagan grabbed his bag and walked out the door. He spent the cold night sleeping in his car. Do you believe that? The only people who would do something like that is a fanatic Christian. Yeah, a Zionist Christian. It was shortly after Reagan's smashing re-election victory in November 84, that Chancellor Helmut Kohl invited the president to visit West Germany the following spring. Kohl suggested that to mark the 40th anniversary of the end of World War II and as a symbol of strong post-war relationship that had blossomed between the U.S. and the Federal Republic of Germany, the two leaders stop at a military cemetery where both American and German soldiers were buried. Kohl also proposed that he and Reagan visit the site of the Dachau concentration camp. Reagan had no objection to either. Within days, however, the West German officials were quietly indicating to their American counterparts that they were having serious second thoughts about the Dachau visit. The White House at first refused to remove Dachau from the president's itinerary, but the German entreaties grew more emphatic, and Reagan, who at any rate was much more comfortable visiting inspiring and uplifting venues, decided he wouldn't visit Dachau after all. The back and forth between the U.S. and West Germany over the president's forthcoming visit had been conducted behind, conducted behind the scenes in early winter months of 1984 and 85, Reagan himself lit the first flames of controversy when he publicly announced in late March that he would not be stopping at Dachau during his upcoming visit to West Germany. He had no desire, the president said, to impute guilt for the war to a new generation of Germans. And then he made the astonishing statement that very few Germans living in 1985 were old enough to remember World War II, and none of them had participated in Nazi atrocities. So there you go. And most of the Germans in that cemetery weren't even SS. Probably by this time, Reagan was already having senility problems, and which I don't think his last couple of years in the White House he was able to do anything. So Ronnie did a bad thing. He didn't visit Dachau. He probably couldn't remember where it was at. That's it for today. I'll be back. We'll see. This is Friday? Yeah, this is Friday. Well, we'll have another show for you on tomorrow. Won't be a live show, but you'll get a show. 14-5.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.